Infatuated with animation from an early age, Mark Dindal applied to only one institution of higher learning when he graduated from high school, and that institution was CalArts. Happily, he was accepted, but at the midpoint of his education in Valencia, Mark was hired to do effects animation for Walt Disney Productions, and he quickly found himself working on The Fox and the Hound, Mickey's Christmas Carol, and The Black Cauldron in rapid succession. After a short time away from Disney's, Mark returned to supervise the effects unit on The Little Mermaid, which he considers the pinnacle of his effects career. "We did water, rain, magic and fire," he says, "and bubbles, lots of bubbles. I knew when it was over that I would never have a bigger canvas or bigger challenges than I did on that picture." Soon afterwards, Mr. Dindal set his sights on directing and directed a short animation piece that was part of the live-action Rocketeer. He then moved to Turner Feature Animation to direct Cats Don't Dance, then back to Disney's for The Emperor's New Groove and Chicken Little. Today, Mark is prepping Me and My Shadow for DreamWorks Animation. We spoke in a conference room at DWA in Glendale. We are talking on June 7th at DreamWorks to Mark Dindal about his life and career. You grew up in the Midwest, right? Where were you born and bred?
In Columbus, Ohio.
Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah.
And how did you decide, I really want to get into animation?
The first memory I had, I was three, I think, when Sword in the Stone came out. And my grandmother took me to it. And it's such a vivid memory of going to the theater and seeing that colorful animated movie up on the screen.
Yeah.
Because still black and white TV at that time. Or at least we had. That's what we had. And it just made such a strong impression. And I remember thinking then, for whatever reason, I want to do that.
Right.
Even
that's kind of a touchstone. That's
yeah.
Almost exactly what Willie Ito said to me on Friday about,
really?
He went to see Snow White in its first run in San Francisco,
uh-huh.
And he was like seven or eight.
Yeah.
I wanted to do that.
Yeah. I think it just got into my head, because by the time I was six, the other memory I have is that I asked my mother if it was necessary to go through school and college if you had already decided what you wanted to do when you grew up. And somewhere, I think she must still have a letter that I had written. It wasn't to Disney, it was to Hanna-Barbera, because that was what was on television.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, mostly, and the Disney features, there was the Sunday night program, and then the features were every 4 years or whatever
right.
It was. So I had written. Somehow I thought that was a good place to start, and I had written a letter to them. I don't even remember what it said, but the basic idea was, I know what I'd like to do.
Did you write it to Joe Barbera?
I don't remember. Yeah. And I was six, so it's, I don't know, probably in pencil or crayon. But it was basically saying, I know what I want to do. Can I just start already?
Did you get a letter back?
I don't think she ever sent it. But you know, like those two moments of seeing that and being so impressed or you know, so taken by it, and then that other one where this is what I want to do, and that was really what I wanted to do pretty much all the way through, with a very short detour into wanting to play the trumpet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because my parents listened to Al Hurt and the Tijuana Brass, so that was there as well.
Did you ever take up the trumpet?
Oh, yeah, I played it for, you know, all through elementary school, you know, in the band and all that kind of stuff. But there was, the just stronger desire to go into animation.
But in and around the trumpet, you were drawing all of
it. Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. And the Disney movies were such events, because there was nothing like them. They were the only one making them, and only came out every four years. I mean, they had reissues, but... And there was no video cassettes, no DVDs, so they
weren't on TV, so you had to go to the theater
never,
to see them.
Yeah, never. So, you know, when they would come, I would buy a ticket and stay through a couple shows.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then go again. You know, they were, I don't know how long they played, but I at least got two or three screening. I went back.
What ones do you remember seeing that were most vivid in your memory?
Sword in the Stone, yeah. The Song of the South was a really, you know, the animation in that was so striking to me. Let's see, Dumbo, 101 Dalmatians, I remember really, really well. I don't remember Cinderella as a reissue, although I'm sure I saw it.
Yeah.
But Dumbo, 101 Dalmatians are especially vivid.
And you got into the reissues of Song of the South before they went, oh, we're not reissuing this anymore.
Yeah, it was still in the theater.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I remember they reissued that a lot, and then it became, you know, on PC.
Yeah. I saw it a couple of times, and...
The animation is amazing.
It is. It's just, you know, that's the thing that really stuck in my head.
And I'm going to digress. Do you think, because looking at the films you've directed, you've got sort of fast byplay, a lot of your dialogue overlap, that sort of Hoxian, but also I was thinking, oh, Song of the South. Do you think Song of the South has a subconscious pull on the way that you...
It might. You know, I like...
Because the delivery of the Fox.
Yeah. I remember what they would play on, you know, when I would come home from school on one of the channels, because we only had three channels, the major networks, you know, no cable, was they play old movies a lot, and I do remember seeing Arsenic and Old Lace and His Girl Friday.
No, His Girl Friday, yeah.
Is absolutely
the
that. Yeah.
That.
And again, you know, I don't know what it is, because I was 10, 15, just really... you know, drawn to that. And I suppose the Warner Brothers shorts, there was a lot of, you know, fast double talk with Bugs Bunny that had that same sort of. And, Rocky and Bullwinkle and all that.
Yeah,
fast. Yeah. So I always thought that was fun.
Jay Warden.
Yeah.
Bill Scott.
Yeah.
But I just, that there might be something to that with Rosalind Russell and Cary Grant.
Yeah.
It's still pretty amazing, those long takes.
Oh, yeah. Long takes, and I mean, I have the, eventually got the script and would try and follow along, and it's almost, there you turn the pages so fast, and there are no cuts. They're so choreographed perfectly, it's really, you know, quite a, it's like a, you know, a ballet orchestration.
Oh, yeah. it's one of my all-time favorite movies, especially Grant. That just that chutzpah, and all of that. But okay, so you're 10 now. You're in, a teenager. Are you taking lots of art classes and
only the ones that they had in school? But the I don't remember what age I was when I saw the Art of Walt Disney book in the bookstore, the big one. And that and Preston Blair's, was it Walter Foster art books?
Oh, yeah, the Walter Foster art book, yeah. How to Animate.
Yeah. Those, you know, I stumbled upon those. It's just, that was like finding treasure, you know, because they were just so few and far between. And
there was nothing out there.
Not really, no. There was nothing like that. So, you know, those were the things that I, you know, I found and would practice and, you know, draw over and over again, and still have my original copies of both of those books.
Yeah, and then, so you get through high school, and then how do you make the transition from Columbus, Ohio to, you know, Valencia, California?
Yeah, well, I was in it was a small town outside of Columbus called Westerville that we lived until we were six, and then I moved to Syracuse, New York.
Oh, so you were upstate New York.
Upstate New York, yeah, through the rest of that before I went to CalArts, and... the other influences you could send away for the Super 8, you know, like...
Castle Films.
Yeah, yeah, of the, you know, the Wizard's Duel from Sword in the Stone. And that was our videotape from, in that day.
But was it silent, or was it...
It was silent, yeah. I had a Super 8 projector, but not a sound one. That was a real, you know... Something that was...
I had a friend that had Birth of a Nation in Super 8.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Set it up and watch
it. Well, we'd make our own soundtrack to the silent, you know, as the projector showed the thing. But the thing, I mean, it was just things happening at the, I guess, coincidence or fate, whatever. But my guidance counselor's assistant had a nephew who went to CalArts.
Yeah.
And so I was talking to him probably my junior year at high school. This is what I want to do. I had no idea, you know, where do you go to study Disney animation? And I think the only choices were animation program at NYU.
Yeah.
And then she, he didn't know, I don't think he knew about this until she said, well, my nephew goes to this place called CalArts. And so she gave me a pamphlet, and I looked at that and then contacted them and looked into it, and then discovered again that this was a program that had Disney veterans teaching animation, and it was just, there was no...
It was the place to
There
go.
Was the place. There was no other option. I applied nowhere else. I just sent my portfolio.
Wow. And what year was that?
78. Yeah.
Okay.
So it had, I guess, was it 70 or 71 it had opened? It had, you know.
It opened, I think it initially opened shortly after Walt Disney died.
Oh, okay.
But it was real tiny, and it took a while to get going. I don't think they built those buildings for a while, later.
Yeah, so I took my portfolio out. My dad and I came out, and I remember Jack Hanna was running the program, and I think we got a chance to talk to him.
Yeah.
Dropped my portfolio off. He toured us through, I think, and, you know, it was the first, that was fun, his first trip to California, first trip to Disneyland, all of that stuff. And then, I don't know, it wasn't that long after I got a letter saying I was accepted, so.
Wow. So but you got right in.
It was my one application, and lucky enough to have made it in.
That's amazing. So you started the fall of 78?
Uh-huh, yeah.
So 78, 79, 79, 80.
Uh-huh.
And then you're there only 2 years, right? And then you get catapulted down to Walt Disney Productions, as it was.
Yeah. We got, you know, you have your producer show at the end of every year. And at the end of the second year, I got chosen to be a part of the effects animation department. And that was a choice I made in the second year. I think I felt Ken O'Connor, who's our layout instructor, made me aware of effects animation. I don't know. I think I was somewhat aware, but not aware that there was a department that specialized in it.
You didn't know that there was a separate...
Yeah. I don't think I knew that.
You knew character animation, but...
Yeah, I guess I assumed one person just did everything. But he brought in these Pinocchio drawings from Monster of the Whale and all this fantastic stuff. And there were techniques to creating rain or shimmers on ocean surfaces that I think fascinated me, because there's a little bit of problem solving and maybe science behind it. And my dad taught biology at the State University of New York, so science was always something that was in our house, and I was always fascinated by it. And then there was just, you know, sort of the science of effects in general.
Physics and mathematics of it.
Yeah.
Was
there's something really intriguing about that. And then it was also drawing, and it, you know, and it is, I always felt it was something that made the Disney movies, it gave them that much more reality, you know, made the plausible, impossible plausible. So I just was really taken by it. And I also felt that there were many people trying to get into character animation, and there was a need for effects animators, but to my knowledge, there was nobody else.
Nobody was moving in that direction.
No.
Nobody's going towards the character stuff.
So I think it was in that second year that I actually got to go. Maybe Jack Hanna arranged for us to go down to Disney, and I met with Ted Kiersey, who was the head of the department at that time.
Yeah.
And so I got to spend a day with him, and was just really taken by it.
He's still doing it.
Yeah, he's still there. So, you know, it just all kind of worked out. So I shifted gears in the second year and made an effects animation film, and that really focused sort of in the spirit of the old mill.
Yeah.
And
what was in it? What was it about?
It was just a forest setting, and a violent storm blows in.
Yeah.
And lightning strikes and upends a tree that does this very dramatic fall into the water and huge splash. And the next morning, the sun comes up and all is well again.
Oh, okay.
So very much inspired.
So that's tour de force.
Yeah, yeah. And so I got offered the job, and I was 19, and I just was really excited to go. And then I was first job working on the Fox and the Hound, in the effects department.
So what do you remember as your first assignment that was, maybe you remember your very first, but what was your first memorable, something dropped?
I think I started small with ripples, you know, rain, hitting puddles, ripples. It was simple stuff, but I got to animate. You know, that was quite an opportunity.
So you're animating. You jump in, and you're not doing in between. You know, you're animating right from the get-go.
Yeah, right from the start. So that was great. And you know, you graduate up to the bigger things. That, you know, I do candle flames and curtains blowing and things like that. But by the end, I did some of the shots where in the bear fight, Glenn Keane's bear fight sequence where the waterfall. Very dramatic waterfall there.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So I got to do some of that, you know, and so that was, I don't think, I'm trying to think, maybe it was a year or a year and a half I worked on it. So I really got an opportunity to do some.
The picture was a big hit in its time.
I got the opportunity to do some really, you know, fun stuff right off the bat. So it was a lot of fun.
So you get done with Fox and the Hound, and then what's next?
You
did the Black Cauldron.
Black Cauldron then, which I don't remember how long we worked on it, but it seemed like a long time.
There's a lot of effects
in
that baby.
And it was a 70mm widescreen. And so you had to fill the whole frame, the whole field.
It must have been labor intensive.
Yeah, it was. But a lot of magic in that. There's the magic sword and flying pots and there's something I remember I did with one of the witches' homes gets sort of pulled up in a tornado.
Oh yeah. I remember that whole sequence. Yeah. It was one of the better sequences in the film.
And that was the start of, there was a boat in the end that was done computer, mm-hmm. where they would plot it out onto paper. The mm-hmm. computer would draw it onto paper, pegged paper. But for the most part, still, hand-drawn. I think, there was a sequence, Don Paul was in the department, and we did a live action shoot with dry ice coming out of this black cauldron, and that was double exposed in. I think that was Don's idea and vision for that, and so that was fun to work on. So we did a couple of different mediums involved in that.
So, okay. And then you left at some point in there, didn't you leave the studio in the middle, late 80s?
It was a little bit after Fox and the Hound, 84. Mickey's Christmas Carol was in there somewhere.
Yeah, well, Christmas Carol was like 82, 83.
Okay, so that was probably in between the two.
Yeah.
And that was.
And it started and stopped because the strike sort of got in the way of the whole thing.
And that was a lot of fun. Pete, I guess the ghost of Christmas Future.
Yeah, yeah.
The Pete character.
Striking the match
and the whole thing with the coffin. That was the sequence I got to do.
That's really one of the more dramatic, yeah.
So, that was really fun. That was a real fun movie to work on with Bernie Madsen directing.
Yeah. And then, okay, so then after that was the Black Cauldron.
And Black Cauldron. And then we had just begun on Great Mouse Detective.
Yeah.
When I just felt, I guess I just felt the need, maybe because I had been there. That's the only place I had been.
And you've been there 5 or 6 years.
Yeah,
at this point.
5 years. Started when I was 19. Didn't really have other experiences, and so I just I left to did freelance with Dale and Jane Baer. You just kind of got out there and.
And what did you work on with them?
They had
they're doing commercials.
Commercials, but they did a thing for Walt Disney World, Atlas.
Mm-hmm.
And, um, um, I I don't know, I don't remember which pavilion, one of the pavilions. That was a lot of fun. Maybe it's still playing, I don't know.
It might be, a lot of that stuff still is. What did you work on specifically? Were you just doing effects, or did you?
I was doing effects. I was still doing effects. He was, there was a character, I think maybe Andreas animated, an Atlas character, and but he was always carrying around this globe, and it was
Andreas Deja.
Yeah. He was carrying around a globe, and I think there must have been water effects. I do remember animating a rotating globe, you know, again before computer animation.
Yeah, so you had to sort of do it. So you were with Dale for what, a year?
It might have been. Yeah, it might have been off and on.
And then you returned to the Big Mouse.
Yeah, for Little Mermaid. I was writing to John and Oscar Ron Clements before it started, and just giving them sort of, I think I wrote a letter about my thought about how you could tackle those effects and run that department. When I heard they were doing that, it's just one of those things you just, you know, I'm just drawn to. I want to work on that. That sounds like so much fun, and it seemed like there was such an opportunity, which there was, for every kind of effect.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't just, it's going to be in a desert and you'll have effects you'd see there. It was just everything, you know, fire, magic, water.
All kinds.
Yeah, smoke.
Boats floating.
Yeah. And lots and lots of bubbles.
Yeah,
so,
lots of bubbles.
You know, I wrote them, talked with them, and then got that opportunity. You know, and I look back on these things, just like there were things I wanted to do, and so I, you know, contacted the people or whatever, and then ended up getting them.
So you headed up the effects on that picture, right?
Yeah. So I was the head of effects for that, we were looking at using or creating a library, since there was going to be a lot of ocean surfaces, that we could create a library that we could
do a lot of referencing to the Pinocchio.
Yeah,
stuff,
yeah.
It's similar but different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's where I really went and studied that stuff. And, you know, looking into multiplane, you know, shots and things like that, or how they did those things. When I had a chance for sort of the research and development on that project, I spent a lot of time in the morgue, as they used to call it.
Yeah. Now
with
Leroy. I always like as a name rather than the research library.
Yeah, it was in the basement, ink and paint, and Leroy, I think, was
there. Leroy was there with Leroy. All those pipes and
yeah.
Those long shelves.
Long shelves and leaky.
Like the catacombs.
It was, you know, there were just treasures everywhere in probably, you know, like water-damaged cardboard boxes and things like that.
Yeah, oh, yeah, I remember.
But when you went through and you opened these things, and, then, you know, of course they're drawn in pencil, but you'd look at exposure sheets and there someone signed their name, one of the, you know, famous animators, and it's just, it's something about it being in pencil that it's so fragile and it could easily be erased, just made it so much more, like, fantastic to actually be holding those things.
Yeah, no, and nobody looks at the effects.
No. Probably not.
Everybody's looking at the character stuff.
So yeah, so I'd pull that stuff out and look at that. And
maybe the first person in decades.
Maybe, yeah. And then I went into one of the multiplane rooms and found all of these multiplane paintings in a cabinet. And I don't know, you know, they were just shoved in there and forgotten. The distortion glasses that they used to create those ripple effects that you see in Pinocchio, and the underwater sort of ripple effects. I just found a lot of old material. There was rain and snow that was shot, I think, for Bambi on photostats that we used in Little Mermaid. And, you know, just discovering all these things sort of shoved away, kind of forgotten in some cases. And,
so did you do reuse, or did you just simply look at it and use it as reference?
We use the same rain and blowing snow that they had in Bambi. And I think they used it in 101 Dalmatians, the exact same photostats.
Oh, wow.
You know, kind of weathered on the edges, sort of, you know. it's the exact same stuff, you know, and I don't know what they shot for the snow, if it was cornflakes or what it was.
Yeah.
But the rain in the storm sequence where the statue of Eric goes over the side and the boat gets all destroyed are those exact same photostats from that. And then we also used light patterns that you see at the bottom of a pool.
Yeah.
They use those in Sword in the Stone. They were using Sword in the Stone. I don't know what their first, but it was all, maybe it was shot for 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Yeah.
But it's that same stuff.
If it works, you use it.
Yeah, it was just, and, I think they had it cataloged somewhere, but it was so fun to discover those.
Was it
things.
Hard to find the stuff?
Some of it was.
Leroy
know where it was? Oh, Leroy knew pretty much where other stuff, but these photostats were in the process lab, or Ted Kiersey knew where they were.
Yeah.
Somebody knew where they were. We would just look at the stuff and say, where's that? And it seemed like somebody
knew.
Somebody knew. I think Ted knew where a lot of stuff was.
Huh. So you get done with Little Mermaid, and what's your next project? When did you start thinking about, I want to move on from effects animation, because I know when you got into the 1980s, it would have been the 1990s. I'm a decade off.
Yeah.
You fairly quickly moved into directing.
Mm-hmm. I think because the Little Mermaid had, for me, felt like what Pinocchio must have felt like for those effects animators. It just had everything in it. And
so where do you go from there?
It was a little bit of that. I thought, well, now what? The experience, just everything about the experience was just fantastic. So I think I had a little of that feeling and wondering, okay, well, what would be the next challenge?
Yeah.
I think that's probably what pushed me on into working in story or working in directing. I got the chance.
You didn't want to go back and repeat yourself.
I didn't feel like you could top it, I guess.
Yeah.
So, it's sort of the upside.
It was kind of the pinnacle for an effects animator.
Yeah, it seemed like it to me. And then, like I said, the experience itself working with that crew, which was fantastic. It's just everything about it was great, and I just didn't know that it would ever be any better.
Yeah.
So I just felt like the need to try something new. I went in exploration of that, worked on, there's a little piece of propaganda. It's actually Nazi propaganda from The Rocketeer, Joe Johnston's movie, where they needed someone from animation to direct it. I mean, I think it was me and a crew of two other people.
So was this live action that you were directing? Or
no,
was this
is,
animation?
It was supposed to be, like the Why We Fight.
The Frank Capra stuff.
Yeah, and the stuff that Disney did during the war. Those, a little piece of propaganda, but it was supposed to have come out of Germany and was supposed to be a piece on how they would use the rocket pack and the Rocketeer to take over the world. And it was a piece of film that somebody smuggled out and died for to get to America.
So you directed the piece of film?
Yeah. So
did you look at the propaganda films from the
40s? Yeah, and that's where, again, I got to go into dig through the archives. Because now I think they have a lot of them on DVD, but there just was none of that at that time. So you found all that stuff. I think some of it might have been in, what's the department that Dave Smith...
Archives.
Yeah, and I think we saw stuff in there that I don't think
through air power and
things like that you wouldn't find anywhere else.
All those training films that
seen exactly.
50 years.
Because it was supposed to feel, of a period. They stressed it out with the stress
scratches.
Lines, scratches and stuff, and the whole idea was that it was once the American military saw this, they realized what the Germans, the
so
Nazis intended.
So how did you get that gig? Because I looked at the credits, said effects on the Rocketeer.
Yeah.
animated effects.
I think I expressed this desire to direct stuff to Peter or direct something to Peter Schneider, and.
Yeah.
I think he found it. He found it, or Tim Engel, who I spoke with a lot at that time. Somehow, they, you know, they were aware of what was going on, and gave me that opportunity, which was, you know, again, just there was a lot of, you know, blessings, if you want to call them that, that just seemed to kind of come my way.
How long was that piece? About 2 minutes?
Yeah, it wasn't very long. And then we probably worked on it for maybe 3 or 4 months, but it was fun to work with Joe Johnston and, you know, and I wasn't ever a part of any of the live action shoots, but just to be a part of that, it was just a different thing, a new kind of challenge. And, you know, again, it's just sort of broadening my horizons.
So you've got your appetite whetted for directing.
Yeah, it was a crew of two.
You and who was the other?
No, a crew of three, counting, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Phil Phillipson
did
background paintings, and I think layouts were by Jim Byhold.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so it was the three of us. I think that was it.
Made an old 1939 propaganda.
I know. Yeah, it was sort of a strange assignment, but that was fun to do. And then I also worked on story on the... George Scribner's Prince and the Pauper.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you were, by this time, you were doing storyboards on the featurette.
Yeah, that was actually, it was kind of a workbook thing. I was working with Don Yippes, which was really a great experience, you know, to be sitting next to him and, you know, wow, just seeing his, you know, he has such energy in his drawings, and they feel like they're animated, even though they're still pictures. And so it was kind of a workbook type of thing that we did, but again, it was story. We were coming up with story ideas and layout, and so that was a new experience as well.
Mm-hmm.
And but I think what ultimately there were only so many features that were being made and directors already assigned to them. So it's, you know, it's
you knew you were at the back of the queue.
I didn't see. That so I think, you know, in the back of my mind I always think, well, this is what I'd like to do, where is the supply and demand in my favor, you know. It goes back to the choosing effects animation at CalArts.
Sure.
And and so I just started to look on the outside, and then eventually met with David Kirshner, who was doing Cats Don't Dance at Hanna-Barbera, and got onto that.
You come onto that as a director, or did you come onto that as
I came onto that as a director.
Oh, so you, okay.
Yeah.
So he said yes.
Yeah.
Then you guys moved over, you were over in Glendale, I remember.
It was actually, we were in at the building, Hanna-Barbera building, on Cahuenga, is it?
Yeah,
the original building.
Hanna-Barbera building, and you were over there. How long were you over there? Because I just remember you being over
in Glendale?
Yeah, on Grand Boulevard.
We were there, it was 5 years I worked on it. I think we were at Cahuenga for four of them.
Really?
It was for the majority.
See,
we were there.
I think it was just because when I go to the studio, I wouldn't say, okay, this is this unit, this is this unit.
Yeah.
It was just...
Yeah. There's a building that's still there that's next to the original Hanna-Barbera studio site. That's more of an office building that we moved into for maybe a couple of years.
Yeah.
But we went to Glendale, it seemed like for the last year.
Yeah, okay.
Or maybe just a little bit over, because we weren't there very long. It was a nice facility, you know, with screening room and everything, but we weren't there for very long. We were finishing up.
So what was the development art on that picture, because Hanna-Barbera is not known for their features, and you guys got broken out into Turner feature animation.
Yeah.
But you started as part of Hanna-Barbera.
I can't remember if we were...
What corporate umbrella you were under.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, we were in the building there, though, you know, and I'd see Joe and Bill walk by every now and then, which was kind of, you know, when you think at 6 years old, I had intended to write them a letter to go work there, and there I was. So it was just kind of, you know, weird to be in
the
that place.
Has come all the way around.
But the development was just like a typical development. It didn't feel like it was being rushed, you know, in any way. We were doing it just like you normally would, by generating a lot of drawings. Brian McEntee came on early and worked on developing movie moments.
Because that has a nice non-Disney look all of its own.
Mm.
that film.
Yeah.
And I mean, the thing I like about your films are you've got an outlook and a sense of humor and a way of delivering the stuff that I don't see in any other features. Especially, my wife and I have a personal Disney favorite, which we'll get into, which is Emperor's New Groove, which is, and I use that as a classic example. The story that I heard is that the studio didn't advertise it real heavy, and that's one of the few films that it opened not huge, and it went up 50% in its second week, and I use that as an example of that's word of mouth, because that isn't the studio
pushing.
It wasn't
marketing.
Usually it goes down.
Yeah.
So, and that picture came close to 100 million domestic. Yeah. So that's the other thing is each one of your features, I grafted, each one of your features has made much more money than the one before. So
that's a good trajectory, I guess.
You're on the right kind of
it's better than each one. But making less.
What was your artistic point of view on the first one, on Cats Don't Dance? Are you consciously aware of the kind of delivery of humor that you're putting into the films that you direct? Because they seem a lot different than most others that I...
I think it's... I'll find myself reacting to stuff that has a certain charm to it, but not, it doesn't have to, not necessarily that it's, you know, childish in any ways, I guess it's that it feel universal, that it doesn't feel like it's just a pop culture movie, because it's, if it was a TV show, I might have a different point of view, because those get done quicker and they're on the air and you can catch some of those pop culture waves. But a feature, you know, and I think maybe because I saw those Disney features, you know, 20, 30 years after they were made, but they still struck a chord regardless. So there's a certain kind of universal, innocence or charm. I guess it's the feeling that I get when I go to Disneyland, that, you know, it's funny, you can, once anybody walks through the gates, everybody's like their 12-year-old self again, and you see the people on the teacups, and it's little kids and teenagers.
Get right into it.
Yeah, and there's something that, there's that place that everybody would like to get back to.